It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, a Hmong American writer shares her memoir about living in and navigating two different cultures.
First, a contentious battle between Democrats and Republicans over a vacant U.S. Supreme Court seat has come to an end. Today, Neil Gorsuch, judge of the Federal Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit in Denver, was confirmed to serve on the nation's highest court. He filled the seat that became vacant with the death of Justice Antonin Scalia over a year ago.
The dust has hardly settled, though, especially after Republicans circumvented already frustrated Democrats by voting to change Senate rules and override a Democratic filibuster. Joining us now to tell us what the confirmation means for both the left and the right is Russell Berman. He's the senior associate editor at The Atlantic covering politics. Russell, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, is this one of the most hyper-partisan confirmations we've ever seen?
Yes, certainly in the last 25 years, the vote today to confirm Neil Gorsuch was 54 to 45, which was the closest and most partisan vote since Clarence Thomas won confirmation in 1991. Just three Democrats voted for Gorsuch along with every Republican, but most Democrats opposed him.
And how did this battle over a U.S. Supreme Court seat that lasted over a year, how did it test constitutional norms?
Well, in two ways. I mean, first we have to go back to when Justice Scalia died in February of 2016, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and the Republicans refused to take up the nominee of then-President Obama, Merrick Garland, didn't give him a hearing, didn't give him a vote. That was unprecedented, although certainly within their power to do so. There's nothing in the Constitution that says the Senate has to even consider a presidential appointee. But then, you know, fast forward to the election, obviously, we have a Republican president. He nominated Neil Gorsuch. And then it became a question of whether he would get any Democratic votes. And Democrats decided to try to filibuster him. That means that denying him the 41 votes that would be necessary, essentially, you need to get 60 votes to clear a filibuster and get to a final vote in the Senate. And that's been the rule for many years. And so Democrats, more than 40 of them, opposed him. They filibustered him, and Republicans decided to change the rules. And so they voted to lower the threshold for overcoming a filibuster to just 51 votes so that they could confirm him on a party-line vote. And this, you know, there's a back and forth. Democrats did this for some, they changed the rules a few years ago for lower court nominees when they were in the majority. So in some sense, Republicans were just sort of carrying on that change and applying it to the Supreme Court. But it's led to a lot of rancor in the Senate. Obviously, Democrats think this Supreme Court seat was stolen initially, and now they think that Republicans have jammed Gorsuch through by breaking a long-standing Senate tradition.
How much was this debate about the Democratic wrath about the GOP being obstinate about not giving Garland a hearing? I mean, was there a lot of resentment with that? Was there baggage?
Certainly, there was a ton of resentment. Publicly, if you listen to the Democratic arguments against Neil Gorsuch, they were all focused on his conservative judicial philosophy. But in reality, his philosophy is not that much different from Chief Justice John Roberts or Justice Samuel Alito, two appointees of George W. Bush from, you know, a decade ago, who did win some Democratic support and were not filibustered when they came up for a vote. And so it was sort of unstated in many ways, but it really was about what happened with Merrick Garland. This was a gambit by Mitch McConnell that was never expected to really pan out, because people thought, one, that he couldn't sustain it, that they couldn't block that seat from being filled indefinitely. And then Democrats were very confident that Hillary Clinton would win the election and that, then she would get to appoint either Merrick Garland or potentially an even more liberal judge to fill Scalia's seat, and so that they would get somebody, one of their picks in that seat to begin with. And obviously that's not what happened. Mitch McConnell ended up looking like a genius, a very devious genius in the eyes of Democrats. And they're just very angry that this all worked out. And the impact, you can't really understate it. The Supreme Court is divided 4-4 after the death of Antonin Scalia. So, Justice Gorsuch is going to re-cement a conservative majority on the court, potentially for decades to come. And that, of course, could be extended if President Trump gets another pick, if there's another vacancy on the court, whether it's this year or in the next couple of years.
We're talking right now with Russell Berman. He's the senior associate editor at The Atlantic, covering politics, talking about the newest associate justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, confirmed today. Russell, when President Trump nominated Gorsuch, he said he was looking for a judge, quote, in the mold of Scalia. From what we know, and Gorsuch didn't give us too much to go on in his 20 hours of testimony, does Gorsuch fit that mold?
Well, according to conservatives, he does. Based on the way that he is ruled in cases in the 10 years that he's been on an appellate court in Colorado, based on his writings before he was a judge, based on his service in Republican presidential administrations in the past. He is somebody who has really passed the test with conservatives. They were very pleased to see Trump as a candidate last year, put him on his list of potential nominees, and they were pretty jubilant when he nominated him. Now, the caveat to that is you never really know until somebody gets on the court how they're going to rule. The famous example is when President George H.W. Bush nominated David Souter, nearly 30 years ago now. He was thought to be a conservative. He ended up being one of the liberal votes on the court. And that really energized conservatives in the last couple of decades to really make sure and really hold the line and make sure that Republican presidents nominate people that are not going to be another David Souter. And so there's a lot of, there's always going to be some nervousness. I mean, look at Chief Justice Roberts. He's ruled generally in a very conservative way. But, of course, he voted to uphold the Affordable Care Act, which conservatives, consider an apostasy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll see how Gorsuch actually rules, but they're very confident that he's going to be conservative, and Democrats are too, and that's one of the main reasons why they opposed him.
Russell, one of the most contentious issues of the Trump administration is immigration. That includes the various iterations of his travel ban, which focuses on Muslim-majority countries. If that goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, what might we expect from a bench with Gorsuch on it?
Well, that's a big question. We don't know, as I said, and as Gorsuch said in his hearing, how he would rule. He did speak out when Trump, in the context of a lower court ruling about the travel ban, when he criticized judges. Gorsuch did speak out and say, that was demoralizing to see a president mm-hmm. attack judges in that way. But he wasn't talking about the substance of the case and whether the travel ban is constitutional. It's possible that his vote could make the difference and uphold the travel ban. It's also possible that he could vote to uphold the travel ban if it gets to the Supreme Court, and the court could still rule it unconstitutional because the swing vote on the court remains Justice Anthony Kennedy, and it's not clear that he would give that, he would be supportive of the constitutionality of the travel ban. So there still could be a 5-4 majority or even a 6-3 majority potentially against the president, against the administration on this. Like many cases before the court, we just don't know until they hear it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Really quickly, before we let you go, Judge Gorsuch will be sworn in next week. What can we expect between now and then?
Well, there's going to be a ceremony at the White House and a ceremony at the Supreme Court. This only obviously happens once every several years. And so there's going to be a lot of pomp and circumstance. And then he's going to be, I think the first arguments that he's going to hear are going to be next week. So he's going to be jumping right in. They have another couple months left in their term. And so it begins very quickly for him.
Thank you so much, Russell.
Thank you.
That was Russell Berman, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic, covering politics. He joined us to talk about the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court today. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up on Food Friday, we'll be diving into a comic book that is also a Korean cookbook.
Right now, we're taking a look at one woman's experience with tough choices and reconciliation. Mai Ning Mua is a writer who spent many of her formative years in Minnesota, which, along with Wisconsin, has one of the largest Hmong communities in the country. Her new book shares her experience as a Hmong American woman.
It tells the story of what happened when she was getting married and decided that she didn't want her husband-to-be to follow the Hmong custom of paying a bride price. Her mother disagreed with her for rejecting a custom that many viewed as a promise of love and security for a bride, and that disagreement had painful consequences.
Mai Ning Mua is a writer and founder of the Hmong literary arts journal, Pandao Voice. She joins us in studio now to talk about her memoir, The Bride Price, a Hmong Wedding Story. Mai Ning, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start out with defining what is a bride price and how does it differ from a dowry?
Right. So in the Hmong community, as with several other communities, the bride price is money you pay the bride's parent for marrying her. And it is different from the dowry in that the dowry includes all the gifts and supplies that family members give the bride to start her life.
And so this money can be in the thousands of dollars?
Yep. There is, in the Hmong community, there is a going rate, if you will, for the bride price. It could be as much as $5,500 or as much as $20,000.
And when you got married in 2003, you objected to the bride price. You didn't follow this custom. Why not?
I did. I really struggled with it because growing up, I had heard all these stories, my mother's stories, about the impact of the bride price on her. And as a young girl growing up, I felt like that was not the thing for me. So I had this idea of not wanting a bride price for myself if I married a Hmong man. And so I did marry a Hmong man, and I told him about it. I actually didn't think he would take me seriously because I hadn't seen other women. I've heard other Hmong women not want a bride price, but no one going through and actually getting that wish. And with my own personal story of having kidney disease and a transplant, I just felt like it was the right decision for me.
Yeah, you said you had multiple strikes against you.
Yes.
And that if people didn't like your story, your memoir, it didn't matter to you. Can you, explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, the multiple strikes is, you know, as a Hmong woman, when I was a child, I lost my father. So I grew up without a dad. And in the Hmong community, which is a very patriarchal community, you know, having a father is really important as the head of household. So that was one. You know, two is that when I, you know, had kidney disease, you know, that was kind of strike two. Some in the Hmong community said that I must have done something wrong in a previous life to have kind of earned kidney disease. And then the third strike was, you know, the way I got married and not wanting a bride price, and I didn't do it right. And so in writing the story, you know, people aren't going to like, people already don't like me. And so I might as well tell the story I need to tell.
You interviewed other relatives. You interviewed Hmong women to get them to get their take on the bride price. Can you read a passage where you talk about that?
Sure. So this is early on in the book, and this is when I am asking my older brother to talk to my mom and ask her not to collect a bright price. And we're arguing about it. So later, I would learn from my elders that the bright price is known as Ri Ming Ri Nong, which translates as the price for milk and care. It is the debt owed to the parents for the milk and care used to raise a good daughter. It thanks them and says, "We are marrying your daughter." It compensates the bride's family for their future economic loss because the bride will leave her family. Anything she makes from this point on will belong to her husband and his family. The elders say the bride price is a promise that the groom and his family will love and care for the bride and will not abandon or abuse her. Since they have invested good money in the bride, she is valuable and they will take good care of her. If the groom's family pays the requested bride price, it means they want the bride in their family.
Mm. What happened between you and your mom?
My mom, as a war widow, doesn't have a lot of standing in the Hmong community. And so when I asked my mom, when I had the meeting with my mom and my older brother and my pastors in my house, and we had decided to do a church wedding for us, that was great. You know, and then my uncles, who were not at the meeting, went to talk to my mom individually and separately from that meeting. And they basically took over and just said, you know, this is our responsibility. This is what we do. And as they should, you know, because my father died, then my uncles are responsible for my brothers and I. And so my mom and I had a, my mom and I didn't talk for more than a year. Which is hard to do in a close-knit community where you show up and you see each other,
yeah,
you know, but you don't talk to each other.
But you went to see her at the farmers markets.
Mm-hmm. Yes. After my trip to Laos and Thailand, I came back and I tried many times to call her, to talk to her, to visit her, and none of those things worked. And so I needed a different method, a way that she would understand. And so I decided that what makes sense for her was to go help her in the farm and to help her at her farmer's market stand, that was work she understood.
Did she accept that?
She did. You know, she was by herself. She didn't have a lot of help. And so what Hmong people value a lot is they don't value empty words, but they value work, and they value showing them how you love them. And so I needed, that was my way of showing my mother my dedication and commitment and love for her, doing something that she's really good at and helping her in the way that makes sense to her.
We're talking right now with Mai Ning Mua. She is a writer and founder of the Hmong literary arts journal, Pandao Voice. Her new book is The Bride Price, a Hmong wedding story. It is her memoir. You interviewed a lot of people for your book to bring more into your memoir, to understand more even about what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. What did you learn about the bride price that you didn't know, after writing this book?
So Hmong women are all over the place with the bride price. There are some Hmong women that insist on a bride price because that's how the Hmong community values Hmong women. There are others that insist they don't want a bride price because, you know, it goes against who they are. And then there are others who don't really care. They don't really know. They don't really understand. And so where Hmong women fall on this spectrum, I think, is indicative of where we are with this complex issue of being Hmong in America. And it's illustrative of what my community wrestles with, be both Hmong and be an American, and trying to honor ourselves at the same time as honoring our community.
You've said in another interview that your book is not aimed at telling other Hmong Americans to reject the bride price. What do you want people to take away from this memoir?
Yeah. What I hope this memoir will do is stimulate conversations in my community about what it means to be Hmong in America. I want the young folks to use my book as an excuse to talk to their parents, to ask questions, and to dig deeper. And so it's really a challenge for the community to own who you are and know why you believe those things that you believe. Not a, you know, go against the bride price, but really dig deep and own who you are.
Very quickly before we go, has your view of the bride price changed since you were in your 20s and now as a person older and also a parent?
It has not. It has actually solidified now that I'm older and I don't have to prove anything to anyone else. My views on the bride price have actually been right all along, and I'm much more convinced that that was the right choice for me to have done, even and the only choice I could have made, you know, in my 20s.
Mining, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Mining Mua. She is a writer and founder of the Hmong literary arts journal Pandao Voice. She joined us to talk about her new book, The Bride Price, a Hmong Wedding Story. She'll be talking about her writing and leading a workshop today and tomorrow at UW-Madison.
Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday, and we'll talk to a comic book artist who created an entire comic book full of recipes inspired by her mother's traditional Korean dishes. I'm Judith Sears-Boisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up later in the program, it's our Wisconsin News Roundup. We'll recap the top state news stories of the week, including a look at who Milwaukee County elected to sit on the judicial bench.
First, cookbooks have come a long way since the days of scrawling out recipes on 3x5 white index cards. Most cookbooks today are full of large, colorful photos and detailed steps and tips for preparing the food. But what happens when you combine a cookbook with a comic book?
Robin Ha joins us now. She's not a chef. She's actually a comic book illustrator whose work has appeared in the pages of Marvel Comics and Heavy Metal Magazine. Her recipe comic book, Cook Korean, contains colorful, humorous comic illustrations that show the ingredients and steps for cooking traditional Korean recipes. Robin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me here.
So you've actually been drawing comics longer than you've been cooking. So let's start with the drawing. When did you get started drawing?
I wanted to be an artist since I was like 7 years old. I started reading comics just as I was old enough to read Korean alphabet. And I just got really hooked. So I didn't know what else I wanted to do with my life other than drawing comics.
What was your life like in your young years and your mom cooking?
My mom was a busy working mom, so she had not that much time to cook, but she cooked for me like every day. Every meal she made was delicious, but she made it like so quickly that I had like no idea how she did anything. So I thought it was something that I could never learn to do. And I just stuck to drawing comics. So when I was young, like, I never had interest in cooking until I grew up, actually, and I had to live by myself in New York. That's when I started to cook.
And so you've been drawing since you can remember. You've been cooking since you've had to basically feed yourself. But how did you decide to write a Korean cookbook and make it a comic book at that?
So I was sharing a studio in Brooklyn with other cartoonists, and one of them, Ellen Lindner, was editing an anthology about food, and she asked me to contribute a comic. So I was just thinking about doing a recipe comic for her anthology. And I actually had a lot of fun drawing this one-page recipe comic for her anthology, and I thought, like, maybe I could do this for fun. And at the same time, a lot of people around me were getting really interested in Korean food, and they're asking me how I made all this food I bring to work. So I thought that was just a good way for me to, like, share my recipe with a lot of people. So it just kind of came out really naturally. I never thought of making a cookbook. It was just a side fun project that I can kind of take my mind off of other design work and just do something for fun. And then next thing I know that I get an email from a cookbook publisher asking me to do a cookbook.
Wow.
So, yep.
Robin, we are so excited to cook with you. Can you, first of all,
thank you.
We really want to get into it here. Tell us about the key ingredients used in Korean cuisine.
So we have the 7 key ingredients that you absolutely need to have to make anything Korean in Korean cooking. And they are Korean red chili flakes, we call gochugaru, and soybean paste, we call doenjang, and toasted sesame seed, and toasted sesame oil, fish sauce, and soy sauce, and most importantly, red chili paste, we call gochujang. So most of these are actually available these days at a regular grocery shop. Like I found gochujang in Giant and Whole Foods, and you know it's really amazing how far Korean cuisine has come in America. Basically, you need to get these. If you can get it at an Asian grocery store, you should go and, you know, just have fun time shopping there. But if not, you can actually order these online, too. And gochujang and gochugaru, those are kind of the key ingredients to make your food spicy. Like, Korean food has this reputation of being spicy, and it usually comes from these two ingredients. You probably would like to go to Asian or Korean grocery store to get those too.
Yeah.
We're talking with Robin Ha. She is an illustrator, a comic illustrator, and she's written a comic book cookbook called Cook Korean. And Robin, I have to tell you, I really love Korean food. And I think in large part, it's because of all those great little side dishes that come with every meal. It's like a little picnic smorgasbord. Tell us about those accompaniments.
So we call those little side dishes banchan, and there's like hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of them. But there are a couple that are really key in Korean banchan. They are called kimchi. Kimchi is like, most people know it as a napa cabbage or daikon radish pickle, but you can make kimchi with like any vegetables. It just has to be salted and fermented. And the other one is called namul, which is basically like blanched or sauteed vegetable dish. And I think kimchi is probably the most famous item in Korean cuisine. And a lot of people think it's like difficult to make or like something they couldn't understand how to make it, but it's actually very easy to make. And I would recommend people to actually try making it at home because it's really... making kimchi takes like an hour or two these days. Like, you don't really have to bury it in the ground or anything like that the way traditional Koreans did. But if you make it, it goes a long way. You know, it really doesn't go bad. And you can eat it like when it's actually really well fermented. It tastes better. And you can use it in like Korean spicy stew called kimchi jjigae or like kimchi pancake. Or kimchi fried rice, you know, there's so many different ways to use it. So it's definitely something you should try.
In your cookbook, you show different variations on kimchi. Tell us about the secret to making really good kimchi and these different variations on it.
So kimchi is basically salted and fermented vegetable. So you can actually kind of tweak your own seasoning. So if you don't like too spicy food, you don't really have to put that much chili flakes in there.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that you should salt your vegetable with plenty of salt. And you need to leave it in salt for long enough time that your vegetable is kind of limp but also kind of flexible. So, like, let's say if you're salting Napa cabbage for Napa cabbage kimchi, you should leave it and you would know when it's well salted, when you can bend the leaf and it wouldn't break. You know, it will just bend because it's salted.
And is there
so
a kind
of... It...
Go ahead, Robin.
So when you bend it, you know, like if it's not salted well enough, the Napa cabbage would break. It will snap. You know, but if it's well salted, you could bend it without breaking it.
And does it matter what kind of salt?
You should use a kosher sea salt, like a big crystal sea salt.
So, Robin, your book also has a lot of noodle-centered recipes. Can you tell us about your recipe that we have featured on the Central Time Facebook page? It's spicy cold noodles.
Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite dishes to make in the summertime, and it's, like, so easy to make. Basically, you have to boil the noodle, and you have to make the sauce with gochujang, the red chili paste that I mentioned. And the topping can be anything between, like, your favorite salad material, like lettuce and cucumber and, you know, tomato if you want, anything you like. But I usually put kimchi on top.
Oh.
Because kimchi has that fresh kind of like spicy kick to it. And what makes this cold noodle dish very special is the sauce. And it's like really versatile sauce that you can use it for not only this dish, but you can also use for other like bibimbap, you know, the rice dish with like a lot of vegetable on top. Or anything you like. It's a really good sauce to have just on the side. And you make it with the gochujang, the red chili paste, and vinegar and sugar. That's the key ingredient. And I usually add pureed apple in it.
Mm.
Traditionally, you should use Asian pear. But Asian pear is kind of hard to find sometimes, or it's very expensive. So I just use a regular, like, Fuji apple, and they taste great.
On these sauces you're making here, are you measuring or are you just tossing together and tasting?
I mean, when I cook for myself and my family, I never measure anything. And, like, most Korean mothers or anyone Korean would never measure anything. But to write this book, I had to measure everything, and that was probably the most difficult part about writing this book.
Well, we appreciate you taking that effort so the rest of us can follow in your footsteps. We're learning how to cook Korean food with Robin Ha. She's the author of Cook Korean, a comic book with recipes.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you love Korean food? If so, what's your favorite Korean dish? Or maybe you're a comic book fan. What do you think of the idea of melding a comic book with the cookbook? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Robin Ha, author of Cook Korean, a comic book with recipes.
And you can share any Korean food-related questions or comments with us by calling 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you cook Korean food at home? Tell us what your favorite Korean dish is. Or maybe you're a comic book fan. What do you think of this idea of a cookbook comic book? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Robin, you devote a good bit of space in your cookbook comic book to porridges, Korean porridges called juk. Tell us about those.
Mm-hmm. So juk is basically like pureed rice. So, like, it's really good for kids who, like, doesn't have much teeth in their mouth, or, like, if you're old and weak or if you're sick, because it's very, like, easy to digest. You don't have to chew anything. And it's actually a big part of our cuisine, and there are some really fine dining juk, like, traditional juk that, like, used to be in King's Table. And also they're, like, pretty versatile. You could put anything, any vegetable or any meat on it, just like how you'd make grits or like a gumbo, you know, like seafood gumbo or something like that. It's very similar in that sense that you basically boil grain for a really long time, and then it becomes very mushy, and you just add, like, a flavor to it. So, yeah.
There are sweet and savory versions.
Yeah, yeah. So I usually like kind of sweet juk. And one of my favorite juk is hobak juk, which is really easy to make. And it's really healthy because it's like 99% pureed pumpkin.
Ooh.
There's not much else in there. Yeah. So in the fall season, I always make hobak juk at home. So you basically boil kabocha, squash, I guess is it squash? But I mean, it's kabocha. Kabocha has more sweetness already in their pumpkin. Like, you don't have to add too much to it. So you basically boil it, and when it's really soft, you puree it, and then you boil it again with some rice flour to thicken it, and you add more sugar if you like more sweet flavor. And we usually put little tiny rice balls in there. We call ongshimi, which is basically like a rice cake made out of glutinous rice flour. And you can buy it or you can make it at home. It's very easy to make. And it's just a really good treat. And then you can eat that cold or hot, whichever you like.
So Korean barbecue seems to be very popular right now. What are the flavors or ingredients or the way of cooking in particular that makes it Korean barbecue?
I think you need to make galbi in basically like an open flame. So it's you don't have to have a charcoal or anything, but like you got to have a really high temperature to cook it right. So You can use gas stove or you can use charcoal also, but the way we grill it is that we grill it right on the table. So if you go to Korean restaurants, you'll see like the hole in the table, and they actually put charcoal in there or have a gas burner, and you can eat like basically sizzling right off the fire meat. So that's, I think, what makes galbi really special. And also the flavor, we use a lot of garlic in our seasoning, and I think the garlic flavor and the soy sauce season that we use, that kind of defines the Korean barbecue flavor. So, like, the soy sauce and garlic and also sugar, that's kind of the main ingredient that goes into the galbi sauce. And you don't have to use the rib, beef rib. You can use also pork or chicken or any other turkey if you want, any kind of meat. And also the way we eat it, we usually wrap it in a lettuce, like a fresh lettuce.
Ooh.
And you can also grill other type of vegetable. We usually grill more garlic on top on that open flame. Or you can add kimchi or fresh green pepper to make it even more spicier. And you just like pile it on a fresh lettuce with the galbi and also white rice, cooked rice, and then you wrap it, and then you put it in your mouth, and it just makes it a lot more, like, nutritious and also very flavorful.
Do you baste that meat? Are you doing anything to the meat before you're putting it on the grill?
Oh, yeah, we have to marinate it.
Okay.
So you make the sauce that I mentioned.
Okay.
And then you usually put kiwi or Asian pear in the sauce.
Okay.
So that fruit has some kind of enzyme to break down the protein, so it makes the meat more tender. So you should put it in the refrigerator for at least 3 hours in the marinade, so the meat kind of soak up the flavor and also becomes more tender. Then you cook it.
Okay.
So, Robin, you also have a chapter highlighting Korean cocktail recipes. Can you walk us through the what you call the three unspoken rules of drinking in Korea?
Yeah. So a lot of foreigners who go there, they have no idea about this rule because nobody talks about it. But every Korean person knows this, and I don't know who made this rule, but it has always been this way forever. So the first, I think it comes from the Confucius teaching about like respecting the elders. So when you drink, you should always pour drinks for the elders. So elder can be like old people, but it can also be just somebody who's older than you. Like even if they're like 1 year older than you, they're still your elder. So you have to pour them a drink, and when you pour them a drink, you have to pour it with both hands. So it kind of like you're cupping the other hand that's pouring the drink to kind of like steady it or make it look more polite. So that's the first rule. And the second rule is that once your elder drinks their drink, they'll offer you a drink, and you can't refuse it. You have to drink the drink that's poured from your elder. So it's very considered rude to refuse drinking from your elder. So if if your colleague is older than you and they're all, you know, they love to drink, then you're in trouble because they'll keep pouring drinks for you and can't refuse it. And when you drink it, you have to face away from the elder when you drink the drink. Yeah. And the third one is that you should never pour your own drink. It's a bad luck to pour your own drink. So yeah, somebody else has to kind of check on you, see if you need more drink, and then pour your drink for you. So it kind of promotes like even drinking, you know, like not one person drinks too much or like too fast, you know. So everybody kind of enjoys the social aspects of drinking together. Yeah, it's viewed really bad luck to drink by yourself in Korea. So you're always drinking with people and also with food. Which we call anju. It's like kind of like, it could be like light snack, like, you know, chips or whatever, but it could also be like a full-on dinner. So I think it's kind of healthier that way, that you don't like, you know, drink too much and like an empty stomach, you know.
Robin,
and you have more fun.
Robin, I don't mean to circle back to kimchi, but everything comes back to kimchi. So it's okay. I go back to kimchi. I have this fear. I have this fear that I'm going to do the fermentation wrong, so that I never make kimchi because I'm so fearful of getting the whole fermentation part. Get me over this.
So fermentation really isn't. You don't have to do anything. You just have to leave it in the room temperature. And when you should use like a glass jar to pack your kimchi in, and then leave maybe like an inch on the top, because sometimes in like especially hot summer days, you will ferment really quickly and then it will like bubble up, and then like you'll have like a messy floor because like the kimchi just will flow out of the jar. So always leave some room in the top. And you just have to, like, if it's cold, then you should leave it for a little longer time. So, like, for Napa cabbage, I usually leave it out for, like, 2 days.
Okay.
But, but you will see, like, it depends. So, like, if it's hotter days, you don't need to leave it out for that long. So the way you check it is that when you look at the kimchi juice in the jar, you'll see little bubbles forming. So that means it's ready. So the bubble comes out when it's fermenting. The, lactic acid is making, like, gas.
Robin, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That was author and comic illustrator Robin Ha, and her book is called Cook Korean, a cook comic book with recipes. You can look at the recipes on the Ideas Network.
When you think back to science class, the message was that species evolve over long periods of time to adapt through genetic changes in their DNA.
A writer on the Science Alert website says that it can be helpful to think of DNA as a recipe, while RNA is the chef that's combining the ingredients in the dish.
Well, new research shows that octopuses and their close cousins, squid and cuttlefish, are coming at those genetic changes in a way that is different than any of the rest of us. They are actually editing their own RNA to better adapt to changes in their surroundings, like the temperature in their ocean homes.
There's been a lot of news stories about octopuses being great escape artists, and of course there was Paul the German octopus, who was very accurate in his soccer predictions.
Much of the RNA editing done by cephalopods is in their nervous system, so scientists are going to be looking at whether that accounts for their unusual intelligence. But if you were hoping that an octopus relative, like a nautilus or a gastropod slug, could help you pick lottery numbers, you're out of luck. That part of the family tree doesn't have the same talents.
Darn. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk about the top news, state news stories of the week in our Wisconsin News Roundup. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.